This is PCJ Radio International.
Hello everyone and welcome again to another edition of Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio International. We begin right away because we have many things to get to on today's program. The internet giants Google, Yahoo, Facebook, and eBay have criticized Singapore's move to tighten regulations of news websites. In a letter to Singapore's Communications and Information Minister, the web companies say the proposed licensing regime has negatively impacted Singapore's global image as an open and business-friendly country. Under the new regulations, selected news websites which report regularly on Singapore would be licensed, and a $50,000 performance bond would be in place. Any story deemed objectionable by the authorities would need to be taken down within 24 hours. Our good friend Sen Lam spoke to Dr. John Yure. He's the executive director of the Asia Internet Coalition, which includes Yahoo and Google and others. He asked them to give a few more details on what these new rules mean.
The first point to make is that it took everybody by surprise, because although we had been in some discussions with the government on internet regulations and Singapore's attitude to internet regulation, which up to now has been fair and free and quite liberal, this came without any consultation with the industry. Everybody was caught by surprise, and we've made the point that all the powers that they have are already in existence. They're all in the Broadcasting Act, so we couldn't understand why now they want to issue special additional licenses to 10 companies, one of which is one of our members, which is Yahoo.
And how exactly will it affect companies like Yahoo?
Well, that remains a bit uncertain, because the implementation process, we've been told, would be light-handed. But how that works out in practice, we don't obviously know at this stage. Ideally, it won't have any immediate impact, which raises the question of then why is it necessary in the first place?
Well, the Singapore government says the new licensing framework is not intended to curb internet freedom, but to make the rules on news websites more consistent, in line with those governing the more traditional media, like newspapers, for instance. So why shouldn't the net come under the same rules?
Well, in practice, it already does, because the powers that the government have, for example, for issuing takedown notices, already exist. So the question is, why extend regulations in this way? Now, we're not aware of another agenda, but it's the signalling that we're concerned with, because while the practice in Singapore has been good up to now, there are other countries in the region where it is not so good. And they will be looking to countries like Singapore to see what direction they're heading in. And that's one of our concerns, that they seem to be heading in the wrong direction.
The Asia Internet Coalition, I understand, has written to the Singapore government. What do you hope that would achieve?
Well, it's already achieved some consultation with us, not about the decision itself, but some assurance that the implementation process will involve consultation, although we're not clear to what extent that will extend to, for example, additional companies that might be included in the future. They've also talked about amending the Broadcasting Act to take into account the fact that many of the internet operators are not Singaporean, so they would look at the jurisdiction issues. And they have said that they will consult with the industry when they're going to introduce changes to the legislation. So we'll have to wait and see how that works out.
And do you think this very vocal criticism of the PAP government's move by companies like Facebook, Google, and indeed your members, the members of the AIC, do you think that this might be a sign that Singapore's place as a regional information hub is far from assured?
Well, in the longer run, everything is far from assured because we live in a very fluid and rapidly developing local environment and regional environment. Let's put this into context. There were moves towards the end of last year at the ITU by some countries who wished to extend state control over internet governance. In that context, we were very keen to talk to the Singapore government that this would not imply some tightening up or change of direction within Singapore. We were given assurances that that would be the case, but of course now, without consultation, these changes have been introduced. That does raise some question marks for us, and undoubtedly international internet companies will be asking questions about where they put their investments, where they put their servers in the future.
Indeed, the internet and related companies or related industries have become an important sector for Singapore, valued at about $100 billion, I understand. Do you think that this might provide your voice a little bit more clout?
Well, our members obviously want to maintain a very good working relationship with the government here in Singapore because Singapore has got an excellent infrastructure and it's got some very progressive policies. It does have a free and open internet access currently. But obviously there are going to be options opening up, alternatives in the future, and our members, and Google, by the way, is a member, and so is Facebook, a member of the coalition, they're inevitably going to be looking at what the alternatives are over, you know, not just in the next 6 months, but over, say, the next 5 years. So the direction in which rules and regulations take place will have a big impact. I should just add that we've had just issued a report done for us by the EIU, Economist Intelligence Unit. They did report for us very recently for India, and they did a survey around Asia asking the question, why is it that it's not Asian internet companies that are going international? Why is it always, you know, companies, for example, from North America that dominate the global market? And one of the key points they raised was restrictive regulations and rules governing internet in many of the Asian countries. So Asia has a choice of which direction to go in, and people inevitably look to places like Singapore for their lead. That's doubly important to us, that they send the right signals, not the wrong signals.
That was Dr. John Uro, the Executive Director of the Asia Internet Connection, speaking with our friend Sen Lam. Well, one country in Asia that has seen a media boom in the last year is Burma, ever since the country opened up. However, there's still a long way to go. Recently, the Burmese authorities have been introducing new laws, but many journalists are worried that this is just tightening things up. To find out more, we have this story from Cynthia Drummond from Radio Free Asia.
Recent political reforms have infused new vigor into Myanmar's newspapers. After 5 decades of stifling military rule, a new government has begun relaxing some media restrictions, including ending a state monopoly on private daily newspapers. But last week, Myanmar legislators adopted a controversial press law that grants the government broad powers to revoke publishing licenses. It also imposes fines on reporters for offenses such as disturbing the rule of law or inciting unrest. The Myanmar Press Council has come out against the legislation. The government-appointed group, made up mostly of working journalists, says the new law ignores its recommendations and restricts press freedoms.
We're going to mail our suggestion and recommendations to relevant committees in parliament and to the president's office. If our efforts are rejected, all members of the press council will resign.
The new law is intended to replace the onerous 1962 legislation, which required pre-publication censorship of all print media. Under the old law, government censors deleted any content they deemed objectionable.
If we're allowed, we want to expand into movies, the internet, and electronic media. But it's restricted now. We want to know what kinds of changes we will see in the future.
Despite recent reforms, Myanmar ranks 151 out of 179 countries worldwide on Reporters Without Borders Press Freedom Index.
And if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Media Network Plus, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. Now, if you want to get in touch with us, there's a few ways to do so. Of course, our email address, which I'll give later on in the program. But also, you can call our answer line. Here's Bob Zanotti to tell us more about that.
Call the PCJ answer line at country code 44-20-3286-1399. That's country code 44-20-3286-1399 and leave your comments and questions. On shortwave, satellite, and the internet, this is PCJ Radio.
All right, we now turn our attention to shortwave. And I don't know about you, but I'm the kind of person that I love to hear about, well, interesting stories around the medium. There are three fascinating books that have been out for a few years now, but they're still very, very good reading. The books are called Broadcasting on the Shortwaves, 1945 to Today, On the Shortwaves, 1923 to 1945, and Listening on the Shortwaves, 1945 to Today. The three books are written by Jerry Berg, and these are three books that I suggest to anyone who's an SWL or DXer to go and find. They are fascinating reading. And there's also some little interesting stories in there that you probably didn't know anything about. Next on the program, Jerry Berg will be telling us about these three books and how they all came about.
This kind of goes back to 1986 when a couple of things happened. In 86, a group of DXers here in the United States got together and decided that we wanted to set up a group to preserve QSL cards for historical reasons, and I was put in charge of that. And so and pretty soon we started receiving QSLs from old-timers in the hobby, and it was apparent that these were QSLs from stations that many of us had really never heard of before. So I became interested in the history of shortwave that way. And about the same time, a local group formed here in New England called the New England Antique Radio Club. It was mainly for people who were interested in antique radio equipment. But I attended one of their swap and sell meets up in New Hampshire, and I bought myself a box of old radio magazines. And in those magazines were in that box were copies of Radio News, which had a great shortwave column. And I was reading about stations that I had never heard of, had never heard mentioned by others in the DXing hobby. And that's how it all started. I started collecting magazines and various shortwave memorabilia, and over a period of years, I collected quite a bit of that stuff, and it just became apparent to me some years later that nobody had ever told this story before, and I had enough material along with some academic stuff that had been published on the subject to put the first book together back in 1999. So that's how it all started.
Were you a shortwave listener before that?
Yes, I've been a shortwave listener since 1958.
Right.
But as I said, this historical stuff just wasn't in evidence. I mean, nobody really knew much about shortwave history before the time that they entered the hobby, and I was no different.
So when you started working on the first book, because you had all this material, was it difficult to decide what to put in the book? Because the first book covers the 1920s to the 1940s, which at that period there was a lot happening in radio just before and at the early part of the Second World War.
It wasn't difficult because I was writing. I mean, it was difficult to sort of physically handle the material, but but deciding what to include wasn't all that difficult because I was writing the book primarily for people in the radio listening community. This wasn't intended to be an academic work. And I knew what they liked because I knew what I liked, and they liked the same things. DXers enjoy reading about QSL cards and receivers and stations and all of that. So I pretty much knew what the content ought to be, and I was able to put the books together with that in mind.
So when you were putting the books together, did you have in mind also to write two other books after that, or was the first one just a one-time thing?
It was a one-time thing. I had no plans to write the later books because I thought that there would be other people who were more experienced than I with regard to the years after 1945, and I thought would be able to do a better job, frankly. So I never really thought about the post-1945 period at all when I was writing the first book. But a number of people said to me they enjoyed the first book, and they said, you know, you ought to really continue this story. And I did have a tremendous amount of material for the years after 1945, and frankly, nobody else wrote it up, and it seemed to be out there kind of waiting to happen, so I just decided to do it. And of course, I was also aided by the fact that I retired in 2003, so I was able to spend a lot of time at this that I wouldn't have been able to do otherwise.
When you were writing the first book, were you did you have access to people that were around at the time radio was king and shortwave radio was taking off?
Some, but not many, because most of those folks were gone. I mean, they were themselves part of history by the time I was writing this. I did have the advantage of having a good deal of material from some of those folks. I was able to contact some of them. Some of the material came through our Committee to Preserve Radio Verifications. And so I had a lot of written material from that time. But there weren't too many people around to kind of ask firsthand impressions of. And I've also discovered that lots of those firsthand impressions aren't necessarily accurate. We don't always remember things accurately. And my experience has been that you pretty much have to rely on the written word to get your facts straight. And even there, you can't always be 100% sure.
When you started writing the second book, which picks up after the period after the Second World War, at the beginning of the Cold War, I mean, the Cold War period was a very interesting time for international radio, was it not?
Yeah, it was a tremendously interesting time. And frankly, I'm of the view that it was the Cold War years that kept shortwave going for a long, long time. Many of the large international stations increased their power largely out of the radio competition of the Cold War. A lot of smaller countries wanted to be kind of represented at the table. They wanted their voices heard. So lots of shortwave countries and lots of shortwave stations came on the air. And I think if you really sort of dig deep enough, you find that it was the Cold War that was really what started that expansion of shortwave, and things just sort of continued on by themselves until 1988, 1990, when things changed in the Soviet Union.
Well, what is actually quite fascinating is just around the time when the Second World War ended, broadcasters like the Voice of America, BBC, oh, at the time I think it was still called the Empire Service, and the CBC International Service, after the war they started to drop languages because they thought, oh, it's not important anymore. And a lot of people have mentioned to me that if the Cold War had not happened, international broadcasting would probably just disappeared, like with many other things from that period.
Yeah, I think there's something to that. I really do. The Cold War kept things heated up, and of course, this was a relatively easy way to for each side to reach into the other, and that dynamic brought a lot of smaller countries along with it. Of course, it also brought some things that weren't so great, like jamming, which was a real scourge during the Cold War. We still have jamming today. The Chinese broadcast kind of place their Chinese musical signals in a lot of places where they don't belong, but it's nothing like the jamming was back in the 50s and the 60s.
When I first started listening to shortwave on a regular basis, For myself, my own personal story behind it was that an uncle of mine had a shortwave radio, and he was buying a new one, and he gave me his old set, and I was tuning around going, oh, this is interesting. What language are they speaking? And, oh, this is interesting to listen to a show from Sweden and stuff like that. So that's how I started listening. I was never really a DXer. I was never really the type that would try to tune stations that were not even targeted to, say, Canada, or didn't even have enough power to reach Canada most of the time. I was just tuning because I thought it was interesting. But one thing I remember very much was, especially in the late 70s and early 80s, when I was doing a lot more listening than I am now, is the amount of stations on the air. It was just incredible. And especially like Radio Moscow, for example. I mean, Radio Moscow had a frequency every 10 to 15 kilohertz, it seemed like.
No question. I mean, Radio Moscow was everywhere. As was the BBC, maybe not quite to the extent of Radio Moscow, but yeah, the bands were full. I mean, the high bands were full of international stations, and for those who DX the smaller stations, the lower frequencies, the tropical bands were just jammed full of stations. Every 5 kilohertz, there was a station. There were dozens and dozens of stations in places like Colombia and Venezuela, whereas today there might be one or two. So there's no question that the high point of shortwave is long past us now.
And I was speaking there with Jerry Berg, who's written 3 fascinating books about international broadcasting. They are On the Shortwaves, 1923 to 1945, Broadcast Listening, and The Pioneer Days of Radio. Second book is called Broadcasting on the Shortwaves, 1945 to Today, which he has updated, and Listening on the Shortwaves, 1945 to Today. It's available as a paperback and hardcover, and you can get it at Amazon.com. But if you want more information how to get the book, just send us an email, which I'll give out later on in the program. And I really would suggest you go and check it out. Check these books out. They're fascinating. Really, I mean, I'm not the kind of person that would rave too much about books, even though I do read quite a bit. But these are 3 that anybody who's interested in radio must have. You really must have them. And surprisingly, what I find myself doing is, if I'm looking for information on something, either for this program or discussions that we're having on our Facebook page, I will use these books almost like an encyclopedia because there's information there which is just timeless. It's just timeless and absolutely a fantastic read. Well, you are listening to Media Network Plus, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. And I want to just remind you about our weekly shortwave transmissions from Trincomalee in Sri Lanka, targeting listeners in Southeast and East Asia on 11835 kHz from 1330 to 1430 UTC. We've had a number of people that have been writing us saying, well, what's going on? Because the tests were initially only supposed to be for 4 weeks. Well, the response to these transmissions has been so overwhelming that we have decided now to extend them to the beginning of August. After that, we will decide what we're going to do. Now, the original plan behind these transmissions was to collect data. The data being how many people would be writing in, either by snail mail or by email, so we can have an idea of how many people are listening. And the only thing I can say right now, because I'm still not finished putting it together, I'm a little bit, I think the word is overwhelmed. I think that would be the appropriate word to use. Overwhelmed. So, tune into those transmissions. You can find information about them at our website, www.pcjmedia.com, where you can also find our Twitter feeds of some upcoming editions of Media Network Plus and other things as well, related to PCJ, of course. Anyway, time now to find out what we can expect propagation-wise over the next 7 days. Here's our good friend, Dan Hensley.
Here's propagation from July 13th to July 19th, 2013. A 10.7 centimeter flux of 135 on July 13th, July 14th, 120, July 15th, 125, July 16th and 17th, 120, July 18th and 19th, 125. The A index will be 5 from July 13th to July 16th, July 17th spiking at 10, July 18th and 19th spiking high at 15. The KP index will be 2 from July 13th to July 16th, on July 17th up to 3, July 18th and 19th a high of 4. Sunspots 1784, 85, and 87 are in view this week, with 1784 starting to pass out of view. Sunspot 1785 has a beta gamma delta magnetic field that harbors energy for X-class solar flares. July 9th saw a weak coronal mass ejection that had only a weak impact on Earth. People in high northern and southern latitudes who have been waiting for aurora conditions to do far-range VHF and UHF communications will see their wish come true this week. Auroras will present as a result of favorable solar winds at those latitudes. Back to you, Keith.
All right, thanks, Dan. And if you want to hear that propagation forecast again, or rather, read it. You can't hear it this way, but we send it out as a weekly radiogram every Sunday at 0227 UTC. That's 0227 UTC on 9,955 kilohertz. Now, even though that is targeting the Caribbean and Latin America, we've had people around the world telling us that that radiogram is getting through. Anyway, we are now out of time. If you wish to contact us, our email address is mnp@pcjmedia.com. If you wish to listen to this program again, as well as catch all past editions, visit our website, www.pcjmedia.com/Media Network Plus, all one word. So on behalf of everyone that helped put the program together, this is Keith Pahal wishing you well, hoping to see you again in 7 days' time. 73 and 88 to the ladies. We'll be right back.